Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to the world's longest running football fans podcast from CelticUnderground.net. If you like what you hear today, you can subscribe at iTunes. And you can download or listen at a variety of places where I'm sure you can also subscribe. And these are SoundCloud, Audioboom, Spreaker and YouTube. And of course, the website, CelticUnderground.net. The contributors to the site and occasional contributors to the podcast can be found on Twitter. There is the long-running at Celtic Rumours Twitter feed. And then there is also myself at Harry Brady CU. There is at Hullboy, at LackeyMore1, and the catchiest of all, at Stephen62572390. Now, is that a man with a fantastic Twitter name who's doing the podcast this week? So, this is enough from me, Harry Brady. Over to him, St. Anthony, who will do the usual guest introductions.
It's my great pleasure to be joined by Pat McGinley, ex-Celtic player from the 1990s. So as always, Pat, we're just going to begin by saying, what was the first game you can recall as a boy, and who was your first football hero?
I'll go with a second, but football hero would be, I think it's either between Dalglish, and I can always remember Archie Gemmell scoring that great goal in the World Cup, so I think between those two, I'd go for Dalglish. And my first memory of football, first game... I don't know who the first game would be. I think I snuck in once to an Old Firm game, and I snuck in at the Jungle. I must have been about 12. I got a lift over by a guy called Willie Calhoun, who was a fantastic character. He ran the Smiddy bus from Partick, and he must have threw about four or five young kids over that day at the game, so fantastic.
Did they win?
Can't remember, hopefully.
Too far back. So you had quite a humble beginning in football. You started off at Blackpool as a teenager. How did you end up down in Blackpool?
I played for a team called Annieslan Waverley. The treasurer of Annieslan Waverley was a guy called Archie Sharkey, and he was one of the chief scouts for Blackpool. So there was me and another guy called Graham Hay, who was a big centre-half, blonde, good-looking, big chap, but I was more of a scoring midfielder, so they took the two of us down for a trial, and they signed the two of us for a year's contract.
And did it not work out? Was it homesickness or whatever?
No, I think it was. I think they were in the third division at the time, and they'd no money. I think it was a laundry company, a Glasgow guy who ran a laundry company, who were paying both of our wages for a year. I think I was there for two seasons. Then Peter Cormack, who was a assistant manager at Hibs at the time, was watching one of the reserve games for Blackpool, and he must have seen me at a light, and I come up the road to have a trial with Hibs.
So that must have been the time Alec Muller was manager.
Yes.
And were you quite excited about the chance at Hibs?
It was fantastic. You know, I think when I was playing for like Glasgow Schools, I had a trial with Hearts and things like that, and never got taken on. And eventually I went to Blackpool. I had two seasons down there. And then obviously got the trial with Hibs, and it was all from there. It just kicked in.
So you made your name with Hibs as a goal scoring midfielder. Is that something that came naturally? Scoring goals?
I think so. I think I always wanted to play up front, but I don't think it was the biggest, and I don't think it was a natural goal scorer, you know, that way. So I was always maybe better coming onto the game from midfield. Played with some great players, obviously helped a lot by scoring a lot of goals, but no, I was more coming into the box late and maybe getting my chances from there.
So you would have been there when they won the League Cup in 91?
Yes, I was in that team, yep.
So that would have been Gorham, Collins?
Yep.
Tommy Mactagh, Murdo McLeod,
Tommy Mactagh, Graham Mitchell, Keith Wright, Brian Hamilton, Mickey Weir.
Because it's kind of ironic, I know he's won the cup, but beating Rangers in the semi-final was a real achievement, because Rangers had that expensive squad at the time and some big name players in it, and that was an achievement for Hibs winning that semi.
I think winning the semi, I think, gave us the confidence knowing that we were actually going to win the cup. I think you knew then that we were up for beating Rangers at Hampden. Great experience, and I think the confidence just grew from there after beating Rangers in the semi-final.
Mm-hmm. So 1993, so summer of 93, your contract was up, is that right?
Yes, it was. I was trying to get a better contract off at Hibs. I think obviously limited resources at Hibs, but I was looking for a bit more money. I thought I was playing well for a couple of seasons, scored a few goals, and then obviously heard that Celtic were interested. But at the time, Celtic had no money either. I think they had to sell Joe Miller and Stevie Fulton to get some funds together, and they ended up taking it to a tribunal where they had, I think they paid £525,000, which was a lot of money for.
Well, you were actually you were actually a big signing in the respect that you were a big summer signing that summer.
Right.
And the one thing we did need at the time was goals from midfield, and you know, there was a lot of hope that you would fit in quickly. I mean, McStay was there, Collins was there, and things were going. But Brady was the manager, so I'm interested in what you thought of him at that point.
I liked him because he'd signed me for Celtic. You know, I thought he was obviously a gifted football player. Obviously, you don't know him as a manager and things like that until you go there. But when I went there, there was a lot of disharmony at that time. You know, that way that players weren't happy with Liam, and Liam wasn't happy. He was trying to build his own team round about. Mm. I think Charlie and Packy and all that were all there, and they were, I don't know if they were coming at the end of their careers, and Liam was trying to get a new team in sorted, and it was a wee bit of disharmony. But for the two seasons I was there, it was fantastic, just because obviously coming from Partick, playing for Glasgow Celtic, it was always a dream, you know, that way. So I wasn't interested in all the politics and stuff like that, so I was just interested in playing for the team and hopefully playing well.
It was an unstable time at the club because the takeover was about to take place, and you know, the directors were under a bit of pressure. Is that something that the players would have been aware of at the time? Did that affect you?
It did. I think a lot of people said at the time it didn't, but I think obviously fans were involved and all this sort of, and there was a lot, wasn't a great team at the time. I don't think that would be bad to say that. We're moving to Hampden. There was a lot of upheaval and a lot of going on behind the background. I think it did affect the team, but on a Saturday you just concentrate on the game, but in the background I don't think it was a great place at the time when I was there.
Remember the thing that backed the team sacked the board?
Yes.
So as much as you want to back the team, it would have been a bit unsettling.
It was, it definitely was, you know. And I think when you see the crowds now, like 51,000, I think playing at Hampden there was like 20,000 and 30,000. The atmosphere was poor. When I went there at first, it was at Parkhead. We started off well the season I went, but there was always this happening at the club at the time I was there.
So one night in October 93, Celtic lose to St Johnson at McDermott Park, and Liam resigned the next morning. So as an individual, were you sad to see him go?
I think you always take responsibility. I think that's the big problem. Players nowadays, I think they don't really care, but I was quite conscientious, and I think a lot of players had let Liam down, and we weren't playing that great. Obviously, we'd beaten St Johnson. Celtic, at Celtic, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but you have to win every game. And one defeat is obviously a crisis, because everybody expects you to beat all these teams, and football doesn't work that way. And I think it was a lot of players obviously let themselves down, and Liam at the time.
Now, Lou McCarrie came in quite a fanfare at the time, and you know, the early signs were good for Lou, because the first game he let Frank Connor be in charge, and we beat Rangers at Ibrox.
Right,
so you'd have played that day.
Yep, I did.
So that was the game Ali Maxwell sort of blew it. So firstly, what would have been like in the days in a Rangers Celtic game at Ibrox? What kind of feeling you've had?
Well, when I was at Hibs, I played with, like, say, George McCluskey and Graham Mitchell, who are Joe McBride, young Joe McBride, sorry, and they were all big, massive Celtic fans. So you knew, obviously, George has told you stories of his experience playing Old Firm, Joe McBride, and Graham was obviously our best pal with Maurice Johnson. So it was a great experience. I sort of knew how it would be, but you can never, until you run it in that tunnel, in the crowd, they just go absolutely crazy. It was one of those ones you're going out and your tummy was churning, you felt sick, you felt nervous, didn't want you to let yourself down. But the experience you'd never forget unless you've played in these games.
A lot of guys say that it passes by in a blur.
Absolutely, it's crazy. And I remember Frank Connor saying about the time, he says, enjoy it, don't let it go by, don't let it be a blur. And it was one of those games you thought to yourself, just flew by, you know. I think if you're doing well and you're getting on the ball and you're winning, it makes a difference. But atmosphere, it can never ever beat it.
So going back to Louis, McCarrie's quite a criticised individual. You know, I've heard guys speaking about him, and I was going to say that nobody's got a good word to say about him. That sounds quite cruel, but I don't think his heart was in it. Did you get that feeling as well?
I think it was difficult because he came when it was a bad time, you know, and everything was going bad, and the players weren't great players at the time, you know, and we were just trying to get through as best we can. But Lou just, his training wasn't the best. Mm. He sort of, he was like fleeting in and out. He was there, but it was always like, always felt as if you were getting punished. You know, everything was like a running exercise. Everything was like drills. There was no enjoyment. But when he was there, it was quite good fun. He would get stuck in it training himself. Mm. I don't know if the job was too big for him. I think that may have been, and a lot of players and managers who go to Celtic, I think the job is too big. I think when I went there at first, I didn't realise how big a club it was, and obviously just a very small part of that. But you learn quickly how to adapt to it, and you try and sort of make yourself better and become more integrated in the club. But I think the job may have been too big for him.
He had a big coaching staff as well. I mean, I'm struggling to remember some of their names. Ashley Grimes and Peter Henderson and
They were actually,
was Mike Martin there? No, he was Liam Brady, wasn't he?
He was. Lou as a person, I liked Lou. I think he was quite funny. He had good patter. Mm-hmm. The coaches were quite good. I thought the coaches were quite good. Was it Peter? I can't remember his second name actually. He was actually quite a good coach. Mm-hmm. And the thing for a player, if you're getting picked in any manager's team, you get on with the manager. It's as soon as you don't get into the team, mm-hmm. then obviously people criticise the manager because they're not playing. But I was in Lou's team quite a lot.
So not long after that, the takeover came and Fergus took over. So what was the feeling like in the dressing room? Were the players happy that this was it coming to an end and happy that there was new owners? Or are you just professional enough to play through it?
I think you're just professional. I think, you said earlier on, Saturday, you can't wait for the Saturday. The Saturday's the best feeling. I think players don't really know that much. People, you're coming home at night and people were phoning you saying, what's happening at the club? You never knew until something actually happened. Obviously, Fergus was coming at a time where he was trying to get a bit of money together and he put his plans across as to what he was going to do. So from that point of view, it would probably be a bit more settled. But I think the team still wasn't as good as what it should have been for a Celtic team.
Now, you had a good record against Rangers, Hartley, and you won more than you lost. But there's one great Rangers game I need to ask you about, and that was the game that the Celtic fans were locked at.
Yes.
And it was supposedly only Rangers fans in there, but obviously there was Celtic fans scattered all over the place. And you had that wonderful aeroplane that flew over the top saying, hail, hail, it's Celtic Arena. On the pitch, would you have been aware of the aeroplane? Did you know that at the game, or did you find it afterwards?
I think someone had said that was going to happen. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who was it organised it, but I think we were told going to the game that it would be something that's going to happen. There would be some sort of surprise, and obviously you could see or hear the plane going across. Mm-hmm. So for that, you knew Celtic fans were going to be sneaking in somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think people, mad Celtic fans, were going to let that happen, you know, and it was, you just knew everybody was behind you, you know, that way.
What kind of, I know the atmosphere in a Celtic Rangers game is, you know, is something else, but the fact that we didn't have any fans here, was it an eerie atmosphere? Was it weird?
It was kind of weird because you're not getting your fans behind you. You know, if you need a wee kick up the backside, you can hear them in the background and pushing you on and urging you on and stuff like that. But it was eerie. Yeah, and I think the result made it even as good, you know, so you were okay. But missing your fans at an Old Firm game is pretty daunting, actually.
It's actually quite sad because that epoxy deflection done us out of one. Right. I mean, Colin scored one of the great free kicks that we all knew he was capable of, but I'm trying to remember the Rangers going, I've got this vision of the Bonner's going to save it and somebody sticks a leg out, and it was an untidy goal. It was a horrible goal.
I think it was just, but I think getting that result with no fans, things against you, takeovers and all this sort of thing. And I think after the game, I can remember going back to Parkhead and going up to one of the lounges, and there was like thousands of people there, you know, that way, and they were trying to buy you a drink and all this sort of stuff. So it was good afterwards because you had a good result, actually. So it was okay.
And that summer, Lou McCarrie took Celtic over to Canada for one of the was a tournament in Canada.
Yeah.
I think we played Hearts and Aberdeen and maybe a couple of other teams. And by the time we come back, Lou was out and Tommy Burns was in.
Tommy was a fantastic coach. Breath of fresh air, knew the club.
I was just about to say, you think you're a jinx at this point because this is your third manager.
This is
if you count Joe Jordan, it's four.
I think it was. is the transformation at Celtic for the two seasons was unbelievable. You couldn't write it. And when Tommy came in, I think everybody got a lift from that. Obviously knew the club, knew the sort of setup of how it was going to play, and when he came, it was obviously very good.
Now you were in the team when Tommy took over, and you bedded in, you were playing there. In fact, I meant to say you were a top scorer the season before.
Yes,
which is unusual for Celtic, for a midfield player, maybe a bit top scorer. It must be something you're quite proud of.
Delighted with that. I think a lot of players go to Celtic, they play a handful of games, and it doesn't matter, you've played for the club, and nobody can ever take that away from you, and it's great to be the top goal scorer for that season. But you wanted more, you know what I mean? You wanted to be up the top of you wanted to win things, and it was, for me, that was the most disappointing in my time at Celtic. I thought I was going there and we'd hopefully win the league, win a cup, or win something, and it was disappointing. But just for the fact that you played was fantastic, special.
Now, August 94, you're in the team, Tommy's took over, and he's probably changing things, but he's taking his time. And one of the early season form was terrific. And then we went to Ibrox and beat them 2-0. And my recollection is that Tommy Burns made you man of the match that day, because you had such an outstanding game.
Yeah, that was nice to hear. I think just before that there was rumblings that he was trying to get different players in, and because I was maybe worth a bit of money, he was trying to sell me for other players to come in and stuff like that. So it was a wee bit of disharmony for myself, but for Tommy to come out and say after the game was fantastic.
Do you remember that?
I do, actually. I think I've probably taped a lot of these things in interviews, and after games you watch it on sports scene and stuff like that, so I remember him saying it.
Because Rangers had just signed Basil Boley and Brian Loudrop, and you know, I don't think we'd signed them, to be honest, and they were strong favourites, but we just didn't win that day. We played them off the park.
That's right.
And it was one of the games that McStain Collins clicked.
Yes.
And Collins got the first goal with a free kick, Paul got the second goal and off the post.
Right.
But I wonder if you remember, there's a great cameo Paul did that he nutmegged Duncan Ferguson.
Right.
And he ran into towards the edge of the penalty area, did a wee shimmy and cracked the ball off the post, and Gorham was nowhere.
Right.
And see if that goal went in, the roof would have come off.
Oh, God, I.
Because today, all that, the one flowing movement shows you what a great player he was at his peak.
Paul McStay was probably one of the most gifted players, I think. I don't think Paul was ever the quickest, but
no.
He's holding the ball in, holding players off, setting players up. His passing was great. I think he got criticised a lot for maybe side passes and all this sort of stuff, but when you're actually playing with these players, Paul McStay was an absolutely marvellous player, and I think he could have probably moved well in his career, and he'd have had a wonderful career. But he was so loyal to Celtic, and I think that was the only problem he ever had. But gifted player.
I mean, for the sort of Puritan football fan, Paul McStay was a Rolls Royce, you know. He was the kind of guy that you just love to watch. But what kind of captain was he?
He was quiet, but I think I don't think a captain always has to be shouting, ranting, raving. I think if you're a good player and players are respecting you for the role that you're playing, obviously playing midfield and being a captain of Celtic was great, because you knew if you were in any problems, Paul would take the ball in a difficult situation, help you out and make a good pass. Then you thought, right, the responsibility was on him, and took it off you a wee bit. So I think, not being a ranter and raver, I think he was very clever in what he'd done. He was a fantastic footballer, and he didn't have to be a shouter and a swearer.
Now we're coming to a sad part here, because you've done well in that Ibrox game, everything's looking rosy in the garden, and yet within about 3 or 4 weeks you're away back to Hibs.
I knew it was on. I think Tommy had said to me that he was trying to sell me. He was trying to sell me to Motherwell, and obviously I knew Hibs were in the background, but it was one of those ones, you knew when he started leaving you out of games and stuff, putting you on the bench, you knew he was trying to get other players in, obviously, God rest him, Phil O'Donnell, and he knew that was a sort of light for light players he was trying to, and he had, I don't know if he had anybody else to sell or whatever, but I was probably the one that he could get a bit of money for, and obviously I was the one that was to go. But listen, I was the time I was at Hibs for 2 seasons, great experience. Disappointed that we never won anything. Tommy, a gifted coach. But I would like to have stayed a bit longer if I had the chance.
Now, the thing about about leaving was you were going back to Hibs. So, but it still been Muller manager at the time?
Yes, it was.
So it was quite a seamless transition to move back to.
It was easy. I think it was easy because Alec Miller was, he was like a father figure, because I went there and I was only 19 years of age to Hibs. Obviously you've seen the progression it was making, obviously went to Celtic, but I remember meeting him at the hotel in Glasgow, and he says, listen, I'm here to take you home. And it was one of those sort of nice things, you know, that way, because at Celtic you're really not really, it's a massive club, where Hibs is a small integrated club where they, you know everybody, you can, you know everything that's going on, where Celtic was such a vast big place, and I knew then it was the place to go back to.
Now, just as we were talking there about when you were leaving with Tommy Burns, there was a story at the time, I don't know if there's any truth in this, but obviously, you know, rumours abound that Celtic gets done with Phil O'Donnell because they paid all the money up front. Apparently what you do with a transfer is you play a down payment and then you pay the rest over maybe a period of 2 or 3 years. So I think the story that we heard at the time that you had to go was Phil had come in and spent all their money, and then they wanted Tosh McKinley and they didn't have any money left. So basically, I know Tosh is a pal of yours for years back, so you had to, you or somebody else, and you, to be fair, you were a saleable asset at that time.
Right.
Because, you know, if this all makes Dear Collins, the fans would have
went crazy.
They'd been a riot. So, unfortunately, you were, it would have been nice for you and Tosh to play in the same team.
It would have been fantastic. Me and Tosh obviously went to St Thomas Aquinas. Mm. But no, I don't know that story, but I knew they'd paid a lot of money for Phil. I don't know that. I think, as you said, I was probably one, apart from Paul and John, they could have got rid of, but I think at the time they needed a bit of money. They spent, I think it was $4 million on Phil, who was a fantastic player, great left foot. I remember his first game, he came in, scored a couple of goals, I think, his first game at
Phil. Yep.
great player. So, listen, I enjoyed my experience. Great. Mm. Nobody can ever take that away from me. I loved every minute of it, and I still go to this day, so it was great experience for me.
Now, looking back, I know you were saying there that it was a time upheaval at the club, and it wasn't maybe the most settled time, but I was talking to Michael Kelly maybe about a year ago, and he's still of the opinion that a better manager would have done more with the squad that he had, because see, when you look at it, you're bothering goals, you're the likes of Dovcek in defence, yourself in midfield, John Collins, Tom Boyd, Paul McStay, these guys were international players. We also had Charlie and Frank McAvaney who were coming to the end of their careers, but they still had a wee, you know, on their day, they still had a spark in them. So he's of the opinion that McCarrie and Brady should maybe have done a wee bit better. So I think what I'm trying to say in a roundabout way is, given the talent at their disposal, do you think they should have done a wee bit better?
I think so. I think
because if you can't finish first, I mean, we weren't even finishing second, we were finishing fourth and maybe fifth.
I think that was a disappointment, as I said earlier on, that was the biggest disappointment. I was going there expecting, from my point of view, I was going to help the team with hopefully my goal scoring, that we'd push on and win a league or something like that. But yeah, maybe you're right, you know. I think the difference was, you seen Tommy, the difference he made when he came in, you know, they were all of a sudden, I don't know if players were maybe disloyal to Lou and Liam, maybe they thought they were different cards that they couldn't go on with. Where Tommy came in from a different perspective, everybody respected Tommy, obviously, for his playing career, and things weren't going well. You soon knew when Tommy was a manager, if you weren't playing right, you were getting criticised, you know. And I don't know if Lou and Liam sort of really realised what the club was all about, but Tommy made that difference. And Michael's probably right, because we should have done better, as you say, naming all those players. We should have been fighting for honours, and we weren't. Third and fourth place was an absolutely embarrassing situation for us at the time.
Thinking back to Lou McCarrie, I remember when he came, he left in 73 and he was coming back in 93, and he was looking about and everything had changed, you know what I mean? I mean, it changed utterly. I think the only guy that was still there on the books was Neely Mauchin. He was the only one that Lou could relate to. So I think Lou maybe thought he was going back to the old Celtic, but when he got there, I don't think he appreciated the level of disenchantment that the fans had with the board, and I think he got embroiled in, he probably got caught in the middle of the politics between the board and the supporters.
I think Lou did, obviously we had Charlie who was there for a long time, and Frank and Packy, they knew the situation that was going on, and they were three experienced guys, and they were probably sort of going between as well, between Lou and that. And I don't think Lou got on with Charlie or Frank, and especially I don't think got on with Packy Warner either. I think it was obviously disharmony, and when they were sort of no filtering things through to us, things weren't that great. So I think definitely, I think the club was maybe too big for Lou, but if you get a chance to go and play for Celtic or be the manager of Celtic, mm-hmm. I don't think you can ever knock it back.
Definitely. And one thing that I don't know if you're aware of this, you were the last guy, wee bit of Celtic trivia, you were the last guy to score a goal at the old Celtic Park before it got demolished to make the new stadium.
Is that right?
I only found that out. I read it online the other day there and I looked it up, and it was May 1994. I won each job at Partick Thistle. I don't remember anything about the goal or anything. I don't think it was one of the games you particularly remember, but statistically you were the last guy to score in the old the old pitch in the old stadium.
That's unbelievable. I'll need to try and dig that out. My daughter works for the BBC, so I'll need to try and get some, mm-hmm. see if she got any old footage or anything like that. So, no, that's great to know. I'm going to let everybody know that when you get back home tonight.
And current day then, do you keep abreast of the current Celtic side?
I go to the games, yeah. I try and go as many games as I can. I've got a great friend, Peter Jordan. He's got a table at Parkhead. I'm invited up hopefully quite often, and it sounds really bad here, but I like to go to the sort of so-called bigger games.
Mm-hmm.
I like the European games, like games against Aberdeen, Dundee United and the Hearts and stuff, mm-hmm. like that, so I might be getting a bit slaughtered for that, but I prefer those sort of games to
the Ross Counties and Hamilton.
You see that.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me at the moment that some Celtic fans are pints half full or half empty, depending on what you think. So speaking as a supporter, how do you feel at the moment regarding the state of the club in terms of Ronnie Dial and the team?
The thing that not annoys me, I think, obviously Ronnie's doing well in the league. I think all of us, Aberdeen were pushing us. I think that was quite good for us because it kept us on our toes a wee bit. Aberdeen obviously faltered away. But the thing for me is everybody else, you want to have a good European run. Mm. And the games, Ajax, Molde, I don't think they didn't even look that great.
No.
And I think we just let ourselves down. I think we were creating chances. Defensive, we looked a bit dodgy.
Mm-hmm.
Big Craig Gordon was early part of the season, looked brilliant. And I think a couple of the European games, I don't know if he didn't look at his best. And I think the defensively, we were a wee bit slow and man marking and stuff like that. But listen, Celtic, you will support them. We're one of those sort of diehard fans that we like to go. We'll go every week if we possibly can. And hopefully we get, next season, if Ronnie's still here, we make a better fist of the European games.
Well, here's hoping that's the case, Pat, and just like to thank you for taking your time to talk to us and a wee trip down memory lane. It's just a pity it wasn't a more successful period. If you'd hung about for a couple of years, it might have been different.
If Tom had liked me a bit more, I might have stayed, aye.
Oh well, thanks for your time, Pat.
Thanks, Dean.
I hope you enjoyed that podcast with St Anthony and hero for a brief period from the troubled times of the early 90s. There are more podcasts along soon. The Bucket Collection, which was from the Hamilton game, has been moved to the 19th of December. And it's just all from me and the guys to say God bless. If we don't do another podcast, have a good Christmas and God bless to St Anthony and his family at this time. Cheers. Good night. God bless.
Says that unless there is a substantial increase in the present war effort in Vietnam, the US should look forward to 5 more years of war. In a speech before the Convention of the Veterans of Foreign Wars in New York, Nixon also said opposition to the war in this country is the greatest single weapon working against the US. That's the 7 o'clock edition of the news. Good night.